Ooh. Okay, so the homework 3 has been released, and of these 3 problems are really just base network stuff, so you can almost go directly from the project into those problems. I mean, the first one really is the base network for Springfield. That's where that particular problem started. I mean, I used to have it as a homework problem, and then I made a project also. So you would actually do it by hand yourself for some of the inferences, as against using the inference tool. So it's a simpler network that I'll give you, but you know, you can basically do the inferences. And then this one essentially is to get an idea of whether, you know, independences hold, given, you know, certain evidence, whether something would be independent of something else. And to do this, you need to understand the deseparation condition that we did, okay? This is another base network problem, I believe. And these 3 will become, basically, they're related to what we're currently doing. They're first order logic. So hopefully, I will be done with first order theorem proving by next Thursday, and that's why I have put up to basically the Tuesday after that. If I don't get done, then I'll do something, either extend the deadline or basically not make that particular problem due. Okay. So questions. I'm going to open this a little bit more again, just so that we'll get some sunlight. Yeah. Are there any questions? Okay. So last class we started talking about the first order logic. And basically, this is something that I did on the board, and I just wrote it down once I went back. Essentially, the expressiveness of representations, you want to sort of understand this, because this is a big idea in the entire course. People talk a lot about expressive representations, and you want to understand these ideas. So you can go from atomic to propositional to relational to first order. Relational and first order are basically very close. You know, the main difference is in the first order. So you, as we'll see in today's class, think of the part of the first order that is actually compilable to finite propositional knowledge base as relational. Okay? And you know from last time that there's a little thing that if it happens in the first order, then you can no longer compile it to a finite propositional database. What is that? Functions. Functions are the big bad guys. Okay. The moment you throw in functions, you can no longer compile it to, you know, finite propositional database. So, which essentially means compilation. The very idea of compilation doesn't make sense. You know, if you want to have analogy to programming languages, higher level languages get compiled to much bigger piece of assembly language code. But then, if you also have higher level language, you know, programs, which can get compiled essentially to infinitely large assembly language programs, then you don't talk about compilability at that point. I mean, at least you don't plan to do that compilation. So in some sense, it's a strictly more expressive. So the higher level language is able to express things, not just in a more succinct form, but also is able to say things that you could not have said at all in any finite space in the propositional case. Okay? In the knowledge representation community, people talk about both the succinctness, that means whether you need, you know, pages and pages to say the same thing. If you could say it in a shorter form, then that's good. okay? And also we'll talk about the expressivity in terms of things that cannot even be expressed in a finite space, okay? Anyway, so there is atomic, which is basically states as black boxes, propositional, where you think states are made up of state variables, and that's about it, okay? Relational representations, where you essentially think there are actually relations in the world, there are objects in the world, objects have relations, and so states, a world state essentially it tells you what relations hold between what objects. Okay? Now, of course, that can be compiled down into, you know, a propositional representation, which can finally be compiled down into atomic representation. But the point is, you have more structure this way, and so you can actually use it. Okay? In first order, from relational to first order, the big difference is that you actually have functions, which in a sense, I mean, I put quote unquote for the produce, because the moment you have functions, then you have essentially ability to refer to a potentially infinite number of objects. They don't necessarily produce them, but you know, it's not like just because you said father of, father of, father of Rao, you suddenly produced a person, right? They existed, it's just that you did, now you have the ability to actually refer to that entity. Okay, as we talk about this, and actually, you know, you can keep this in the back of your head, and I'll probably have this as a discussion on the blog, is one of the interesting issues is sometimes a function might actually only map something to one or two values. Do you understand what I'm saying? So for example, parity is a function, okay? And you can take any number, any bit string, and it will say parity odd or even. So if, so essentially in this particular case, the parity of each of the, what we are basically saying is that the functions don't necessarily have to generate infinite number of objects. But one of the tricks that we have to deal with when we are looking at logical representations is the function name that you have, you don't know what it represents in the real world. Okay? And you should be able to reason with the symbols without specifically knowing what they represent in the real world. And you have done this and you've taken it for granted, but it's a pretty darn impressive thing that we have to do it that way. So suppose I say P and P implies Q, then you can say Q, right? You don't need to ask me, so here is one interpretation where P means it is raining, okay, and Q means you can get wet. Okay, that's one interpretation. I can write yet another interpretation, you know, P means you worked hard, and Q means you are tired. Okay, it doesn't matter what the P's and Q's stand for, irrespective of what their meaning is, if P is true, P implies Q is true, Q is true. Okay, and computers can't be expected to know what you mean by the P. Okay, in fact, meaning between propositions comes, you know, gets narrowed down by the way you use them, essentially. Okay, so that's one of the reasons why the moment you have functions, since they can potentially refer to infinite number of new objects, you essentially have to take that into account. Okay, in a particular interpretation, they might actually refer to only two objects. Maybe just one object. I mean, there is this function which takes any object and, you know, maps it to one single object. That's it. That's just one interpretation. Okay? You have to be able to reason with all possible functions without knowing what their interpretation is. And that's the sort of thing. You know, for example, you can't say this, you can't say actually that this is an inference that holds only if P actually stands for raining and Q stands for you can get wet, and won't hold if this is the interpretation. You can't get to say that. Okay? And anyway, so this is the compilability aspect, propositional. So I started, you know, this thing lower down because you can't this is already compiled. This is the assembly language. Atomic representations are assembly language, right? You can compile propositional to atomic with an exponential blow up. You can compile relational to propositional with an exponential blow up and further compile it back to in atomic with yet another exponential blow up. So you can get double exponential blow up. Okay. What's interesting, of course, is the moment you throw in a function, then essentially this is an exponent. I mean, this is an exponential blow up with the exponent being infinite. Okay. That's basically what you want to keep in mind. And so we are now going to look at this first order logic syntax. And, you know, when talking about this, you are in a sense talking also about relational representations, because if you don't have functions, then you essentially have a relational representation. Okay. And we started talking about the syntax. And so the important thing, of course, is you basically using, so remember there are constants, there are predicates, there are functions, there are variables which can refer to essentially generalized objects. Okay. I use the word object to give you semantics, you know, to give you some meaning as to what this could be referring to in the real world, but the actual technical term in the logic itself is term. So term is something that refers to an object. Okay? A constant can be a term, a variable can be a term, a function of terms can be a term. Okay, so that's basically what we'll have. And so in essence, the way you write simple statements, you know, to think in terms of propositional logic, you need to generate propositions that can be true or false using these mechanisms. Okay, so the basic idea would be your propositional assertions will be saying a relation holds between term 1 up to term n. That's what you would say. And so relation should be a predicate name. And the terms, each of these terms are either constants or variables or functions of terms. Okay? That's basically what I'm saying. An atomic sentence essentially almost corresponds to a proposition's name. So if you were to compile this down to propositional logic, then every atomic sentence becomes a new proposition symbol. Okay, so ignore all the parentheses and commas and put dash. Okay, so for example, if you have predicate of term 1, etc., up to term n, then you can just write predicate dash term 1 dash term 2 dash term n. That will become a new symbol. That would be a propositional symbol. Okay, so of course the terms themselves have structure. They can be either constants or variables or functions of terms. Okay, so as I said, a term is a generalized object referent. It refers to, you know, objects in the world. Okay. So here is an example. Brother King John, Richard the Lionheart, Brother King John, Richard the Lionheart. Okay. That's one atomic sentence. And for this to be atomic sentence, it must be the case that you essentially are declaring brother to be a relation or a predicate. Okay, and then King John and Richard the Lionheart better be terms, and in this particular case they are, because they're constants. Okay, and then here greater than length of left leg of Richard, length of left leg of King John. You know, I wanted to make that statement. So in that particular case, greater than is the relation, and here are two objects. Okay, this is one object which basically applies this function to this constant, so it's a term, and then applies this function to that whole thing, so it's again a term. Okay, so I'm just saying greater than term, and so it must be an atomic sentence. Okay, now one thing that you cannot have is basically, notice the way I defined it's predicate of terms, and terms are made up of variables, constants, functions of terms. So what can't they be made up of? They can't be made up of predicates. Okay, suppose I want to say all the relations in my world are reflexive. And suppose I actually just want to say that I have a predicate called loves, okay, and I want to actually say in my world loves predicate is reflexive. Okay, what is reflexive supposed to be? Actually, let me say symmetric. I want to talk about symmetric. Okay, I want to actually just say that it's symmetric. Okay, I would like to be, what I would like to say really is, say, symmetric loves dot dot. This is how you normally write, right? You don't get to write it in first order logic. Why? Because this is, if this is a predicate, it can't be part of another predicate's arguments. So you must be wondering, why is it called first order? This is the reason. If you want to have predicates of predicates, it will be second order. Okay? Now, so in essence, of course, because I did not get to say this, what would I have to say? For every reflexive, every symmetric relation, I would now have to write a separate statement that actually captures the notion of symmetry. Okay, so for example, rather than just say symmetric loves, etc., and then you have a definition of symmetric predicate, relation somewhere else, that's what you would have liked to do. Instead, you would actually have to say, for all xy, loves xy implies loves yx. Now, of course, if later on you find that hates also is symmetric, then you have to write this too. And you are justified in saying, how come I have to write this so many times? I'm a good software engineer. I want to write the definition one place and I keep reusing the definition. Well, that's part of being expressive. But, first order logic has a limit to its expressiveness. It does not allow you to have predicates be functions of predicates, and predicates be terms, and predicates be arguments to other predicates. Okay? So given this, the connection to propositional logic, of course, is every ground atomic every atomic sentence actually is a propositional symbol. Now, actually, it's not exactly, because, this is slightly wrong, because what happens is that the way I wrote the atomic sentence, you can essentially have loves x term, where x is a variable. It is an atomic sentence. Unfortunately, it's basically the x scope is not defined, right? So it has no meaning at this point of time. You have to say, well, how is x scope defined? You could either actually say, well, it's for the range of individuals x term loves x term is true. Okay, so this is an atomic sentence, but it's not a ground atomic sentence. Where a ground atomic sentence basically means no variable. Okay, so strictly speaking, connection to propositional logic is every ground atomic sentence becomes a proposition. And if you have infinite number of ground atomic sentences, God help you. Right? Okay? So that's the deal. Okay? Now, of course, what do I do with this x here? Okay, how do I, if I am interested in compiling it down to propositional logic, I understand I can just talk about ground sentences, ground atomic sentences. But I would like to, if this makes sense at all, if this is an atomic sentence, and I need to make it to have meaning, then what do I need to do? I need to define the scope of x. There are two ways of defining the scope of x, a variable, in first order logic. And those are quantifiers. For all, there exists. Okay, so you can always throw in a for all or a they exist in front of it, and it becomes a well-formed formula. The difference between, an atomic sentence is a formula. Okay, let me just get back to that in a minute. An atomic sentence is a formula, and any complex sentence is also a formula. Okay, a complex sentence is a conjunction of atomic sentences, disjunction of atomic sentences, implication one sentence implying another sentence, and if and only if. And from the proposition, and also negation. And propositional logic, you know that these three essentially is enough, because this is just syntactic sugar. Okay? So those are the complex sentences. Now, you know, of course, I could actually have, because I allowed Laws X term to be an atomic sentence, now all of a sudden I get to write Laws X term implies happy Y Mary. That's a formula now. But it's not well formed, because X and Y, you don't know whether they actually, what they stand for. Okay? To make a formula well formed, you throw quantifiers. You need to explain for each variable in the sentence, how is it quantified. Okay? And the two quantifiers are existential and universal. We started talking about it last class. Think of universal quantification as a shorthand notation for a big conjunction. And think of existential existential quantification as a shorthand notation for a big disjunction. That's it. And the moment you think about that, that way everything about them makes sense. Okay? Once again, I understand you know for all and there exists. You have heard about it before, but I'm just sort of doing it, you know, slightly more formally, hopefully, here. Okay? So in this particular case, you know, so if I don't have this for all, then at X, Berkeley implies smart X, that's a formula. It's syntactically well connected, it's a syntactically correct formula in the sense you have atoms and you have terms inside them. But it's not a well formed formula because X is not bound. Okay? And if you bind the X, then essentially if you say for all X in this case, then it will be a it will be a well formed formula. And it could have, and then you can talk about what does it mean. Okay, and what it means really, if you write it this way, then essentially it would stand for the conjunction. Okay, for with X being substituted by every possible object in your world, every possible, you know, object in your world. Okay, so for example, if the only objects in your first order database are King John and Berkeley, then this is what it stands for. King John Berkeley implies smart King John. King John, Berkeley, and Richard, presumably. So, and then at Richard, Berkeley implies smart Richard. At Berkeley, Berkeley means smart Berkeley. Again, that's what you mean. Basically, you just substitute every possible object in every possible place. Okay? That's what it is. So this is basically a conjunction of all these implications. That's what that for all essentially stands for. And you can see why the conjunction would be infinitely large if you have a function. Because then if you have father of as the function, then you can say father of King John Berkeley, father of King John Berkeley, father of King John Berkeley. And not only that, I'm surprised that the entire semester went by and I only did it today when nobody is here. I can't do anything right now. We'll just clean it later. But the point is that you will also have father of Berkeley, father of Berkeley, father of Berkeley, and so on. Those are extra infinite number of bogus objects. Okay? Because you know that they don't exist, but that's a different story. You know, except, you know, when you write it this way, a function can have essentially, you know, you don't know what the function actually stands for. Okay. Now, this I'll come back to in a minute. Okay, and then there exists is the other kind of quantification, and that's essentially disjunction. That's what stands for disjunction. Okay, so couple of things that you want to remember about first order logic and quantifiers, because these are things that you saw first time, because you know pretty much everything else existed also in the propositional logic. Okay, of course, basically if you can understand that the relation of constant is really nothing but a proposition name, then the things that are new here are of course functions, and we already talked a lot about them, and quantifiers over variables. Okay. And so the question is, it's kind of, you know, good to remind ourselves of the properties of these quantifier properties. So for example, negation of for all becomes there exists. And this should not be surprising, because if not of A and B will become not of A or not of B. And since this for all is really huge big conjunction, a negation in the front, if you take it inside, will become negation, disjunction of negations. And that's why it becomes exists X, not PX. Okay? And then similarly, the opposite is true. Negation of exists becomes for all, not P. Okay? The other thing that sort of you should have noticed by now is quantification is allowed only on variables. It's not allowed on anything else other than variables. You can't quantify over functions. You can't quantify over predicate names. Okay? Variables refer to objects and you get to quantify over variables. That's it. That's another restriction of first order logic. Okay? Yes, I mean it's out of first order logic. There are technical terms for other logics, but you know it would not be first order logic. Okay? Normally, if you have a predicate with predicate arguments, that's second order logic. Okay, but you'll see that by now, by the time of first order logic itself, we are hopelessly this is a hard problem computationally. We'll see in a minute that just finding whether a given theorem is true is only semi-decidable. That means if the theorem is actually true, unbeknownst to you, then before the universe ends, you will find that it is true. Okay? And if the theorem is actually not true, unbeknownst to you, then the universe might end and you still haven't proved to yourself that the theorem is not true. Okay? And this asymmetry, you should not be surprised, by the way. The fact that when there a theorem can be proved, you can prove it in a finite time, while it can't be proved, you cannot prove it in a finite time. That should not be surprising, because to be able to show there is no proof exists, you have to exhaust the space of proofs. Do you understand what I'm saying? So for example, think about, you know, to make a little digression back to something that we already done, think about A star search. Okay? Many searches on graphs can have their completeness and optimality properties are defined in terms of if there exists a solution, you will find it. Because when the solution doesn't exist, if the solution does exist, it has to exist at a finite depth, just by definition. Okay? And so obviously you will find it as long as you don't go off to deep ends before finding the shallower ends. But when there is no solution, you essentially will be forced to look at the entire graph, and if the graph is infinitely large, then you will never be done. You can only show, for example, exhaustion, you can exhaust the space if the space is finite to begin with. Okay? And in for propositional logic, showing that the theorem is not provable was still possible because the space of proofs is still finite, in essence. By the time you come here, it won't be anymore. That's why it's semi-decidable. Okay? Okay, so now quantification is allowed only on the variables. And so you cannot quantify on predicates and say, for all predicates that I have, they're all reflexive. And then define reflexivity using my, you know, second order predicate. I can't do that. Right? Okay? And then the other thing is that the order of quantifiers matters, because basically you can, if I have, for example, if I have something like this, right, both are variables, I can throw in for all x, there exists y. For all, I can also say, there exists y for all x. Okay? And I can also say, of course, other things, for all x, for all y. And there exists x, there exists y. each of them can be said, and they all mean different things. And if you are wondering why they should mean different things, you shouldn't. Okay? If you are ever in confusion, assume that you are thinking in, you know, a small world where there are only two objects. Only two objects, Tom and Mary. So then these all become essentially, you know, depending on how you write these, they all become conjunctions and disjunctions. And you'll get different conjunctions and disjunctions. Okay? And so we'll get to that in a minute. So this is actually, long back, I was one day listening to, I think, Jay Leno on the Tonight Show, and he had this, I thought it was a very good example to remember the importance of order of quantifiers. Okay, so he started by talking about this statistic. According to a recent CTC study, 90% of the men surveyed said they will marry the same woman, and then he takes a pause and says Jessica Alba. Okay, right? The reason it's funny is because after you are done, there actually are two possible interpretations. Okay, one is more likely, other is less likely. And much of the fun comes, much of the jokes come because there are multiple interpretations and you are likely to go with one, and in fact I come and say the other one. Okay, so the whole reason here actually turns out that the question is the same, is this same woman a function of the person who is going to marry that person again, that woman again, the man or woman who would marry that man or woman again, okay, or is it just universally defined? Okay, and I argue that essentially the crux of the joke, and if you want to, you know, lose the entire fun in the joke, you can actually think of the crux of the joke in terms of, for all x, there exists y such that same woman xy, versus there exists y for all x, same woman xy. That's the joke. And if you can look at these and laugh your heads off, then you know you have taken intro to AI. Okay? You'll also be in insane asylums, but at least, you know, it's good. Okay? So, which is the Jessica Alba interpretation here? What? It's the bottom one. Because, in essence, Jessica Alba apparently is not a function of the person. Everybody wants to marry the same person. They are not marrying the person they were married to before, which would be a function of them before. Do you understand what I'm saying? So, this is the Jessica Alba interpretation. And this is the one that you assumed, family values interpretation, okay, which is the reason family values versus Mahabharata, where in fact in the Indian epic Mahabharata, Draupadi is married to five people. So from five to infinite is not too hard. Okay, so that's all I'm saying. Caveat of, so order of quantifiers matters. For all x, there exists x, for all y loves xy. For all y, there exists x plus xy. These are two different things. And if you are in you know, doubt, write down the expansion, and you will realize that it actually makes sense. Okay? So basically, in this particular case, what I've done is I'm first taking this for all y loves xy, and then writing this as a conjunction. And then I'm taking the there exists, and so this entire conjunction is disjoint. Okay? So according to this, either Fido loves Fido or Fido loves Tweety, Fido loves Fido and Fido loves Tweety, both, or Tweety loves Fido and Tweety loves Tweety. That's possibility here. Okay? So there should be one person who is loved by both of them, essentially, in this case. Whereas here, you allow, you know, if you do the same exact steps here, first you will get the disjunction and then you get the conjunction. So all you need is either Fido loves Fido and Tweety loves Fido. Either it is the case that Fido loves, so either this is true, that means Fido loves either Fido or Tweety, or Fido loves Tweety and Tweety loves Tweety. And for this whole thing becomes true if in fact Fido loves Tweety and Tweety loves Fido. Tweety loves Fido. They don't have to both love the same person. Okay, and this is just comes from the direct understanding of conjunctions and disjunctions. Okay, so the order matters, and in particular, the assumption is that we will see this later on. In fact, when we come to a simple way of thinking about it is that this for all, the simple way of thinking about it is that the quantifiers coming inside, the variables coming inside are essentially functions, are functions of the variables whose scope, within whose scope they're falling. Okay, we'll get back to that actually when we discuss removing quantifiers. At some point of time we want to remove quantifiers by a process called columnization. Okay, any other questions? What?
At the bottom line,
uh-huh.
Right,
this one, you mean this one?
Yes,
there,
right?
Yes, yes, you're right. Yes, there's an R there. Okay? Now, actually, let me just say that what I was trying to say in that columnization, we'll find when we get to columnization, you know, jumping ahead, that to columnize a sentence, to get rid of quantifiers in a sentence, you can just ignore the quantifiers and assume that any variable that is occurring is implicitly quantified one particular way. So let's assume that any variable that is occurring is actually implicitly universally quantified, in which case essentially you have to get rid of the existentially quantified variables, because if you leave them also, then you think they are also universally quantified. Okay, so what I would say, there is this process called columnization we will talk about later, and what you would say is this exists why there exists why here is actually a function of x, because this y is falling in the scope of the x. So this this is basically some function of x, some made up function of x. That's what I've been saying. Okay, so this is the family values interpretation. The person you're getting married to is a function of the person. Okay, whereas here, since y is, there is nothing on this side, it's a function of zero variables, which means it's a constant. A function of zero variables is just a constant. Okay, anyway, we'll get to the columnization again later. Any questions? Yes. Okay, now I'm going to say a few things about let's do this first and then we'll go back to those previous sentences. You know, you can write stuff you know in first order logic databases, okay, because you know how to do quantifications, etc. Okay, so apartment pet is a pet, that is small, dog is a pet, cat is a pet, elephant is a pet, dogs and cats are small, some dogs are cute, each dog hates some dog, spider is a dog. Okay, I suggest that here is one way I can write it. Notice that I can make up my predicate names. I can make up my function names. All I need to do is be consistent. If I use something in the place of a predicate once, I don't get to use them in the place of a function later. This is the same way programming language, you know, you write programs. You can call your variable anything you want. But if you declared it as an array once, don't try to use it as a function in the same program. Then your, you know, compiler will yell at you. You just have to be consistent. You know, you decide upfront what are your function names, what are your predicate names, what are your constant names. And then as long as you use them in the right places, I don't care. So there's a compilation error versus a meaning error. Okay, so you know that in the programs, I mean, at least they won't even compile if you wind up using something both and having declared as an array, you try to use it as a function. It won't even compile, because I can tell that you made a mistake. But of course, after not doing any syntactic errors, you could still do large number of other errors, which are basically logic errors. And so the program does run and does produce something that's not what you wanted it to produce. Okay, in the context of logic, essentially the only person, just as in your program, the only person who can figure out whether or not the program is doing what they expect it to do is you. The same way here. Okay, as long as you don't do any syntactic errors, you know, essentially your first order logic database has a meaning. It may not be the meaning you expected it to have. okay? And to understand how the meaning goes, you have to understand things like this. Basically, you have to understand how the, you know, logic itself, you know, how the quantifiers get expanded and so on. Okay. So here, so for example, for all x, small x and pet x implies apartment pet x. And for all x, dog x implies pet x. For all x, cat x implies pet x. For all x, elephant implies pet. Dog implies small. Cat implies small. Dog. And this one basically says, some dogs are cute. There exists x, dog x, and cute x. Okay, my question is, why is that correct? What would have happened if I wrote that sentence as there exists X, dog X implies cute X? Some dogs are cute is what I said, right? And why can't I say there exists X, dog X implies cute X? You are likely to do this. And I'm always worried about telling you the mistakes that you're likely to do because you actually go and do it in the exam. Because you would never, you'll forget everything else I did, and then you will remember that, yes, Rao did say something about if there is not P or not Q and P or Q, he said something about it. Must be that it is empty class. And anyway, I'm running out of time, let me put one. At least 5 people did this. After I spent 2 slides just explaining that that's not to be done, right? It's like, you know, this is this idea of framing, you know, Lakoff talks about framing. Nixon came on to the TV and said, I'm not a crook, right? And everybody remembers crook Nixon. They've forgotten the not part, okay? Don't bring up the elephant, you know, in the room, okay? Anyway, actually, sometimes when I tell you about the mistakes you're likely to make, I'm worried that you will actually make it because you'll forget the context around it, okay? But I'm going to tell you that this is a mistake you're likely to make and you shouldn't. Somebody was trying to explain to me why it's a mistake.
It says that if a dog exists, then it's cute.
Yeah.
But that leaves open the possibility that the dog exists that's not cute.
So, what are you saying?
That's wrong because there's no possibility for a dog to exist that is not cute. But that is possible.
No, this is wrong because essentially consider a world where you have only Tom, and it so happens that not dog Tom. We know that Tom is not a dog. My question is, in that world, is this satisfying? I didn't even tell you anything about whether Tom is cute or handsome or ugly, anything. Okay, let's see what happens. What did we sign up for here? What we signed up for here is this, since there's only one guy, Tom, right, then essentially this corresponds to dog Tom implies cute Tom, which is not dog Tom or cute Tom. In your world, is this sentence true? Yes, it is. A huge big disjunction is true if one of the disjuncts is true. You understand what I'm saying? You could care less about whether Tom is cute or not. As long as Tom is not a dog, this sentence is true about Tom. And maybe that's not what you want. You didn't want this sentence probably to be true in this world. Most of you didn't. If you wrote this kind of a sentence for this world, most of you who wrote these sentences would think this sentence shouldn't hold in a world where dogs don't exist at all. Okay? And to make sure that will be the case, then if you write, say, there exists X, dog X, and cute X, that would become dog Tom and cute Tom, and that would be failing. Okay, so that's the way to think about it. So in general, in most worlds, you would probably be interested in writing existential with a conjunction. Okay, and similarly, but in most worlds, you would probably be interested in writing a universal quantification with an implication. For suppose, you know, unlike this guy who thinks only some dogs are cute, you know, I just picked up when I went to get my coffee, I picked up this thing called West Highland Herald, and apparently it's a dog paper. I just noticed this because it says revolutionary software helps dogs understand humans, dog ears a ripoff. These are all the important articles here. Catnip pyramid scheme sends pooch to pound. So there are people who, you know, who think all dogs are cute. There is no such thing as, what do you mean some dogs are cute? All dogs are cute, right? And they too should be allowed to write sentences, right? And so how would they write their sentences? What would they say? Why can't they say, for example, for all X, dog X, and cute X? That means they are not just dog lovers, but they are insane. Right? Because they think everybody is a dog and everybody is cute. Not just dogs, right? Do you understand what I'm saying? And you should, so you would probably never, unless, I mean, I'm not saying you won't actually have a world where certain properties, two properties hold for every possible object. Okay, so you might be saying everybody in the class is alive and kicking, so for all X, alive X, and kicking X. I can say that. There's nothing wrong with it. But most of the time, I would probably not be interested in saying those kinds of sentences. I would probably be interested in saying a qualified sentence. All dogs are cute. Humans, that's a whole different story. Okay? And so, why do you have to write? So, you have to write for all X, dog X implies cute X. Do you understand this? Okay? So, in general, if you ever, if you don't, you know, you're more likely to write conjunctions in the existential and implications in the for all. If you ever wind up writing, you know, things like this, conjunctions with for all, just stop and make sure that's what you wanted to write. If you're ignorant, proud of it, I cannot help. And you know exactly what you're doing, that's fine too. But, you know, if you stop and think, then you might realize this is what you wanted to do. And same for this. Yes, sir? Which one? It depends on how I wrote. I mean, basically, I've done that. An apartment pet is a pet that is small. And so I wrote it this way.
So the way you have it written, it's possible to be an apartment pet and not be small.
Oh, that's an interesting question. If something is small and a pet, then it would be apartment pet.
But if it's an apartment pet, it's not necessarily small.
That's fine. That's a good point. Now, if I wanted it to be if and only if, then I have to make sure that in English. An apartment, yeah, I think if in general definitions are always if and only if. So I agree with you that you would have written both sides. Okay, but if basically, so if I don't say if and only if, then this essentially allows that every apartment pet, so everything that is small and pet can be proved to be an apartment pet. Okay, but in general this question of going from English to equivalent first order logic, you need to ask yourself, am I exactly capturing the meaning? And once you do that, then everything else happens automatically. Okay? Okay. Then something else. So this is basically more on writing sentences. This is, I just told you this, except a different for all and there exists. Okay? Something else I wanted to say. Yeah, and this also I said, decide whether your symbol stands for a predicate or a function or a variable and stick to it. Okay. Now, so it looks like there is a, so one of the huge implicit promises I'm making with respect to this first order logic lectures is that if you know something in English or in your native tongue and you can write it into first order logic formalism, okay, then we will talk about a semi-decidable procedure, okay, which will be able to prove every theorem that is actually provable. Okay, that's a pretty darn good thing. And so a lot of people in the beginning essentially the idea of automating reasoning is something which has a large amount of, it's a very seductive idea, okay? And so what's interesting actually is the completeness and soundness of resolution theorem proving, which is resolution for first order logic, was only completed, that was shown only in 1962. Given that logic as a whole existed, God knows how long, I mean the Greeks were talking about it, right? But only in 1962 was the mathematical proof completed that in fact, you know, essentially everything that is provable can be proved by resolution refutation. Okay, now that the moment that was done, you would say, hey, look at this. Now anything I know, I'll just write it down and somebody's theorem prover will start putting together my, you know, my knowledge and prove new theorems. It's a very useful thing, and we will be interested in doing some of that in this class. But one connection essentially that, you know, one of the other communities that's particularly excited about this right now is semantic web community. How many of you have heard the word semantic web? Okay, the rest of you aren't reading papers. You know, there is this whole thing about if web pages essentially, apart from having English stuff or Telugu stuff or any other language stuff, also have in the background essentially, in the source code of the web page, if you throw in a whole bunch of logical sentences that describe what is actually there on that web page, then somebody can take the, you know, one of the dreams is I take the information from this web page and this web page and this web page and prove to myself that something is true. Currently, we do it. We integrate the information across web pages using our head. We read the English, we read the English, we read the Hindi, we read the Japanese, put it all together in our head and make a decision as to whether certain thing is true or not. It looks as if you write all of these in some sort of a logical form, then, you know, a theorem prover which sits in W3C headquarters, okay, can essentially combine all these sentences and prove whether or not your theorem is true. So you get to ask now questions in first order logic and get answers and you'll be very happy. Okay, that's the dream of semantic web. And one interesting issue to remember is that when that logic allows you pretty much infinite freedom in making up your predicate names, function names, and constant names. Okay, and so if different people are writing knowledge on their, you know, logical sentences on their pages, it's going to be extremely highly likely that they will make up different predicate names for the same relation in the world, different function names for the same function in the real world. Do you understand what I'm saying? And of course you can say, let's pass a law saying everybody will obey it, and unless you have a huge big jail system to put people into the jail when they don't follow that law, you can't pass a law and make sure that especially people on the web will do anything right. Right, it's an entirely decentralized medium, and so most likely people are going to write different, you know, vocabularies, you know, predicate vocabularies, functional vocabularies, etc. And then now you no longer can put things together unless you are told essentially that this predicate here is the same as this predicate here. So you need mapping axioms. So semantic web community actually comes up with yet another thing now, saying, you know, look, why don't you say, instead of being way too independent, you actually should do the following thing, you know, take one of the vocabularies, you know, so check out one of the vocabularies. Now we won't say one single vocabulary for the entire world. You pick the one that you like, use it in your knowledge base. But if you pick one of the vocabularies that is sort of available, then these are all mapped into the main vocabulary already. And so somebody else does the mapping for you. But this is only slightly better than saying everybody should use this, because ultimately people don't even do this. So eventually what you would need to do to make semantic web happen is either make people actually follow rules, which is hard, or you should be on demand, be able to realize that the predicate here is actually the conjunction of these predicates here. That's not an easy problem. Okay, so but it's kind of an interesting connection because in fact much of this lecture, you know, on first order logic is directly relevant to semantic web. In fact, especially things of this kind. These kinds of sentences, these can be thought of essentially as what? Cat x implies small x. Okay, that means the class of things that are cats are also small. So if you think in terms of the entities in the small, so small is a set and cat is another set. So what is this implication saying? This implication is saying that everything which is a cat is also small. Okay, that means the set of small is very big. And everything that satisfies catness is within that set. So in essence, these kinds of statements are set theoretic relations. This set is a subset of this set. And the fragment of first order logic which mostly talks about sets and their relations is called descriptive logic. So it's like class subclass hierarchies. This class is a subclass of this other subclass. This is other class. And it's a very useful thing to talk about. You know, as you could see, even about pets, we can write a lot of class statements. And under certain conditions, actually, descriptive logic, the complexity of theorem proving in descriptive logic is actually lower than that of full first order logic. And semantic web community is very much into descriptive logic. So they're really into a subpart of the first order logic. So you can feel smug that you know more than what they're actually doing. Okay, if you figure out what's happening here. Okay? So that's all I'm going to say about, you know, the syntax of first order logic and how to write sentences, how to write knowledge bases. There's a lot more, of course, you need to, you know, just as, you know, doing this is like telling you how to write Lisp programs, how to write C programs. You know, how to write syntactically correct Lisp or C programs. Right? You know that I get to give a little lecture, but then you have to go sit and write some. Okay. Now the only difference, of course, is the rest of this course is going to be, rest of this topic is going to be, once you write one of these programs, I have an interpreter for this program, essentially, or a Lisp interpreter, or a C language interpreter, or a first order logic interpreter. And the interpreter is really the inference mechanism. So we now, from now onwards to the, you know, until this topic is over, we'll be talking about the inference. Okay. Now, you know, there's a huge, huge history of first order logic and trying to get, you know, sound and complete inference mechanisms for first order logic. Okay, as I said, you know, the Stoics were stoically doing their thing back in 450 BC. Okay, but it's Robinson in 1965, actually 62 is when he really completed it, but 65 is when I think the JACM paper came out. Journal of ACM paper came out, is when he actually showed a practical algorithm. He's a mathematician. Okay, so you know, when mathematicians say practical, you need to buy like a huge bag of salt and take it with it, right? So it's a practical algorithm, and you know, the rest of our life we'll be spending time trying to make that practical algorithm actually implementable. Okay, but at least he gave you something as to, he basically provided a proof saying this algorithm, in fact, can be completed in finite time. Whenever there's a proof, it will end in a finite time. Pretty nice. Okay. What I want you to understand in today's class, you realize ultimately that whenever you're talking about inference, you need both the model theoretic inference and inference rules, which is proof theoretic inference. In the context of propositional logic, we first did model theoretic inference in terms of tables, truth tables, right? And then we went and did shortcut directly model exponents and resolution theorem proving. Those are all the proof theory. Ultimately, you expect to do the actual inference using proof theory, okay? But I want to at least, you know, in today's class, mostly what I'll try to do is to give you an idea as to how you can construct model theoretic semantics for first order logic. Okay. Normally, you take a semester or two semester long courses and just understanding that part. Okay. But I am in a particularly good mood today, and I'll give it to you in 15 minutes. Right? And I probably won't ask too many questions on this in the exam, but it's worth understanding. because you have a feel for where the semantics come from, and then you start actually using the proof theory, which is what you'll wind up doing most of the time. Okay, which we'll start next class. So in the truth in first order logic, essentially, for everything, you know, remember, if you have a propositional logic, you ultimately had to, if I was talking about truth for a propositional logic database, I had to do the following thing. You know, remember, I actually had that in the beginning of the class. So P implies Q, right? And then I had to explain P is this proposition, Q is this proposition. A statement that can be true in the world, a statement that can be true in the world, and then that would be, so then essentially, these two sentences essentially are talking about those two statements. And this would be a sort of an interpretation. Okay? Now, one of the interesting things is that, did you guys remember, did we actually do this when we did propositional logic? Did we write a proposition and write the actual statement that could potentially be standing for that proposition? Did we do that? How many interpretations are there? What did we say? If you have n propositional, you know, symbols, how many interpretations could there be? 2n. If I start making up, P can stand for Rav is tall. Okay? Or P can stand for ASU is cool. Etc., etc. Different interpretations. How many interpretations will there be? Infinite, right? So you wake up and you realize, we didn't do this. Why didn't we do this? Because in essence we found that, well, actually I didn't even mention this, but even if you did this, ultimately what matters is whether that statement is true or false. I don't really care for whether you want to think of P as standing for Rav is tall, or ASU is cool, or Windows is a bad operating system, or anything. Right? All I care is, in your world, is P true? So one of the beautiful things that we did without realizing, I mean, we were really smart at that time, what we did was we took infinite number of interpretations where each proposition can stand for some true statement in the world and said they really can be put in equivalence classes, such that in every equivalence class where the statements corresponding to P and Q are both true, that's an infinitely large set, but that really corresponds to one world for us. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay? So, doing this kind of interpretation, you know, actually giving names and actually giving real world statements is called Tarskian interpretation. And realizing, and so Tarskian interpretations, there are infinite number of Tarskian interpretations even for propositional logic knowledge bases. It's good to know that, because now when I come and tell you that first order logic also has infinite number of Tarskian interpretations, you think, yeah, that's not too bad. I was sunk already. Right? Okay, so I'm about to tell you that first order logic will have Tarskian interpretations and it will be infinite number of them. The sad part is that in the case of propositional logic, we said all these Tarskian interpretations can be put into equivalence classes corresponding to particular configurations of truth and falsity for these proposition symbols. It doesn't matter what you call them. Whether they're true or false is what matters. And in that case, if there are n symbols, then there are only 2n worlds. And those, really, you can think of them as, although it's not technically called that, Herbrand interpretations. Herbrand interpretation. So what you know is propositional logic had infinite number of Tarskian interpretations and finite number of Herbrand interpretations. And when we come to the first order logic, we will still have infinite number of Tarskian interpretations, but also infinite number of Herbrand interpretations. And why do you think that would happen? Because ultimately, this n is the number of propositions, right? So if I have a first order logic, where do I get the proposition symbols from? From the ground sentences. The thing is to make sure that the number of ground sentences is finite. When do I lose the ability to make sure that the number of ground sentences would be finite? Functions. Okay, I mean, I told you that for most of this course, if I ask you something, say 2 power n, but for the next two classes, if I ask you something, say function. Okay, because that's the answer. That's the bad guy, right? So functions, the moment you have functions, then it is 2 power n worlds where n is infinite. So that's why you think. Okay, that's the deal. So let's see. Here is the Tarskian interpretations for a first order logic. Essentially what you would do is previously the propositions would be interpreted as prepackaged statements in the world that can be true or false, assertions in the world that can be true or false. Instead, now in the first order logic, you basically map constants to objects in the world, functions to functional relations between objects in the world, predicates to normal relations between objects in the world. Okay? You understand, guys, by the way, that functions are relations too, right? And they just have a specific property. Okay? So, functions are mapped to functional relations, predicates are mapped to any other relation in the real world, and constants are mapped to objects in the world. And then, of course, when I say a certain predicate statement, predicate saying love Tom Mary, I will go into the world and construct the equivalent propositional assertion. That means the love's relation holds between the object referred to by Tom and the object referred to by Mary. And if it's true in your world, then it's true. That particular statement is true. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, so that's what Tarskian interpretations are. And not surprisingly, there are going to be infinite number of them. And what I would like to do is, there are too many Tarskian interpretations, and I want you to understand that we had this problem in propositional logic too. We had too many interpretations there too. And what we had to do was to find equivalence classes, which is the same thing we'll do here too. Okay? To get the equivalence classes, we have to find out the propositions. And then all that matters is, whether they're true or false is the only thing that matters. Okay. Now, how to propositionalize? To talk about propositions corresponding to the first order logic, you have to talk about how do you propositionalize a database, first order logic database. I've been saying this all along, essentially, but, let me just show you a slide. So if I have a database like this, for all x, king x and greedy x implies evil x, king John, greedy John, brother Richard John. In this database, if I only show you this database, what are all the constants in this knowledge base? John, Richard, that's it. Okay? And what I'm going to, so this X can only stand for John and Richard. And I argue that these guys are already in propositional form because they're ground sentences. This one is not currently a ground sentence, but it's a big conjunction. I'll just throw in every possible value for x and, in this particular case, every possible value for x. Okay? So, this really stands for King John and Greedy John implies Evil John, King Richard and Greedy Richard implies Evil Richard, and then this and this and this. That's it. That's my knowledge base now. And I would argue that really the proposition symbols are King John, Greedy John, brother Richard John. Those are the only propositions. And I can construct truth table based on just those propositions. And if I know all this, and if you asked me, in this particular case, show that John is evil, which is what you would like to do here, right? In this particular kind of case, if I know all this, normally the kind of thing I can prove is John is evil. So now I have the proposition symbols for this, right? I can make a nice little truth table and do what you did in the midterm, which is, throw in the knowledge base and the negation of the statement that you have, which is John is evil, and show that it'll all go to false, false, false. That's it. You're done. The only question is how big is this table going to be? As long as it's finite, who cares? Somebody will have a computer which can store it. Okay? The problem is it can be infinite because of the function. Okay? So this is a technically dense slide. I'll say it once today and again repeat it next time when we come back, and you can, spend some time on it. But essentially, What we did here is converted this into a propositional database, and the equivalent propositional database is really called the Herbrand database. Herbrand database, okay? And the way you can compute the Herbrand base is given given a first order logic knowledge base, you first compute basically figure out what is the Herbrand universe, which is the universe of all the ground objects. So if you have 15 constants and nothing else, then your Herbrand universe is those 15 constants. If you have 15 constants and one function, then your Herbrand universe is those 15 constants and the application of this function to all those constants, the application of this function to the new constants that have been generated by the first application of the function, and so on. Okay, so in this particular case, all constants, Rao and Pat, and suppose I just have this as my knowledge base. For all xy, friend xy implies like x, likes xy, friend Rao Pat, friend Pat, son of Rao. Okay, and then basically my ground functional terms would be son of Rao, son of Pat, son of, you know. Okay, and those are all the various terms. Each number of applications of, you know, son of function, we can give rise to a different object. So there are really infinite number of objects. The moment you do that, then the ground atomic sentences are made with terms in the Herbrand universe. The way the ground atomic sentences essentially correspond to taking each predicate of n arguments and substituting n of these ground objects into those n arguments. That's it. Okay? And so, if there are n constants and p kre predicates and nothing more, then the size of the Herbrand universe would be n, because there are n constants. And since I have p kre predicates, each predicate has now k positions. Each of them can be filled by n things separately, independently. So n times n times m, n power k. Then there are p of them, so p times n power k. That's the size of the truth table. I mean, that's the size of the number of propositions now. Now you have everything you need to construct the truth table. The moment you have a function, essentially all that changes is n becomes infinite. Small difference. So infinite power k will still be infinite. Okay? Now, the reason, so once you understand this, I essentially told you that everything that you know about semantic reasoning with propositional logic holds true here too. Because, you know, without functions, you will always have a finite size truth table. At least in theory, you can think of doing truth table based model theoretic entailment. Right? The only question that you have to ask yourself is, what happens if I have infinite number of propositions? And the big thing that Herbrand came up with essentially is that he basically showed, and this is before Robinson, okay? What Herbrand basically showed is that if you have a theorem that is actually entailed, okay, that is actually true, then it will be provable by just a subset of this infinitely large propositional truth table. In particular, what he's actually said is, remember, the way the number of objects are increasing is the depth of the terms. You know, terms like, you know, Tom and Mary, they are depth zero objects. Okay? One functional application to Tom, that is depth one object. Two functional applications, that's depth two object. And what Herbrand said is, if a theorem is provable at all, it would be provable on some truth table that's made only of objects up to depth some k, where k is a finite number. So there's no way the theorem would be provable only because you have to look at the entire infinitely large table. So this is an iterative deepening procedure now. So to prove everything, all you can do is you can just start with a truth table corresponding to Tom and Mary, and then if you can prove it, you're done. If you can't prove it, consider depth 1, depth 2, depth 3, depth 4, depth 5. If the current theorem is actually provable, before k becomes infinity, you would have shown that it's provable. If I played a trick on you and gave you a theorem that can't be provable, I would be dead, the universe is gone, you're still checking. Which is exactly what IDDFS does too, if you think about it. If it's an infinitely large graph, and doing IDDFS doesn't make, and there is no solution in the graph, doing IDDFS won't make you stop. It won't terminate. If there is a solution, it will terminate. I'll stop here, okay? Think about the implications of this. Next class, mostly, I'll repeat this a little bit, but mostly focus on the proof theoretic result, inference, using modus ponens, using resolution, and so on. Conceptually, why you can provide complete inference mechanism. No, all I'm saying is basically, this is an argument as to why it is possible to provide a complete model theoretic inference mechanism. That means it will only, it's already found, but it's going to have to be complete in the sense it will prove every theorem that is provable.
Yeah, the other part is
in yeah. Both this whole thing is the way of anything you do it using truth tables, that's a semantic way. That's a model theoretic way of doing it. Okay?
So you are saying that everything that is provable using the truth
tables. Okay, previously I just said he, make up a statement in the world that can be true or false. But now I say here, brother sounds Johnny. Okay, make up a statement in the world that actually corresponds to this brother Tom Johnny. So for that you have to say Tom is this object, Johnny is this other object, brother is this relation that holds in this world, and notice that in that relation, Tom Johnny is part of that relation. Okay, that would be an interpretation.
You can also say here is the relation
in my world. So all I need to say is show me real objects in your real world corresponding to all the constants.
Okay.
And show me real relations that correspond to every predicate symbol here. A relation is written as just a Cartesian, I mean set of Cartesian pairs, right?
Mm.
Okay. So show it to me. Give me one. And then once you give me the relation, I will be able to tell you whether or not my statement holds. Because if I say Tom and Johnny, okay? If my relation doesn't hold, I'll show you. Brother Tom Johnny. Actually, in fact, to make life easier, okay. This is my sentence in the first order of logic. To give an interpretation, I need to give some object in the world where Johnny refers to. So I would say, well, Johnny refers to, you know, this person, okay? And Tom refers to this computer. That's what I decided. That's my interpretation of those objects. Now, the question is, so this basically, now I have a brother, this corresponds to this relation here. Okay? The relation basically has a bunch of things saying, you know, so this relation holds between these two guys.
Yeah.
Okay, let's say it has a tick on this.
Mm-hmm.
And it also holds between, I mean, my computer and itself. Okay? It also holds between my computer. It also holds between my computer and this guy.
Okay.
But this way. Okay. Now my question is, if I said this, now you can ask, is this true? It would be true if Tom Johnny is a ordered tuple here. And that means Tom Johnny would basically look like Tom is this, Johnny is this, so this is that, and it's this. So in this case, this is an interpretation where this is actually true. If I didn't have this, and instead I had this.
Okay. It's an ordered thing, okay, it's not symmetric.
Not necessarily.
It's an ordered, okay, yeah.
Exactly, it's a relationship,
so
basically,
yeah.
Yeah,
function can be symmetric.
Yeah. No, yeah.
This has to be like Tom, and Tom is a brother of Johnny, or like that it has to be interpreted. So okay, so this is our tuple, which we, this is supposed to be our interpretation of this below one, right? It's supposed to be our interpretation, right? Many of these. And that is supposed to be the real world thing that, does this concept actually study first round logic in last semester?
What?
I actually studied this in last semester.
Uh-huh.
Subject. So
uh-huh.
I remember something called an interpretation function. Is
yeah.
The same thing?
Yes.
IGF.
Yeah. Which course did you take? Juhani Lewis course?
No, I took
Okay. Yeah.
It's the same thing, right?
Yeah. But basically, I think the Tarskian interpretation, there are different kinds of interpretations. Tarskian interpretations basically go whole hog and say, here is the object in the world that corresponds to Tom. Here is the object in the world that corresponds to Johnny, etc. Okay. And you know, and a Hebron interpretation essentially says you don't actually need to know the exact object names. You only care about. So basically, what Hebron relation essentially says is the following. Okay, it essentially says that all that matters is whether your world, in your world, whether this whole thing is true or false. Okay, you can construct infinite of these where this happens to be true. You can also construct infinite of these if it happens to be false. And all it's saying is all of these guys are just really one interpretation as far as Hebron is concerned. Yeah, I mean, no, I think basically what I'm trying to do is to explain to you that in essence, if you are stuck to what actually is a symbol referring to, one of the interesting things is computers don't understand, I mean, you know, formal reasoning cannot understand a specific symbol. A symbol has no meaning.
Mm.
Symbol has meaning in terms of how it is related to other symbols.
Mm.
Okay?
We had the
and what is interesting, of course, is so you don't write in Pasara logic, you just in proposition logic, for example, you don't say raining, rain implies get wet, means wet, is a separate rule. You just say for any P, and P implies Q, you use Q. So this will be true if P is rain and Q is get wet. R, P is ASU is school, and Q is you should be happy. It doesn't matter. Okay?
That is why we were so strict on making
TV. Yes, but I think this is more natural. At some point of time, you would ask yourself, why didn't I do this for proposition logic? And also my point is, if you gave Tarskian interpretations for proposition logic, there too you would have had infinite number. Okay? So the Tarskian interpretations, they are both infinite. Except one happens to be a bigger infinity. Yeah.
Okay, one more thing I want to know. The extrapolate portion in this time.
Mm-hmm.
The information theory is what I did not. First thing
Wait. Did Yunsong come? Did somebody
say?
Yeah,
he came.
He came and took the thing.
He came, he saw him, so he must have taken it.
Okay, I didn't jump for okay.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to ask was that this time we were supposed to do everything using the tool. So I was trying to work out this for confirming that the tool gave the right answer. There was this question in which we were supposed to calculate one of the probabilities.
Mm-hmm.
It was like the network, you gave in the variable elimination part, factoring theorem and all, right? That we have to actually expand the joint distribution in a way, and we have to do it in a certain order so that we got the right summation and we could actually
mm-hmm.
sum it down and get so. Now in the exam that will be there in the end sum, you will be probably asked to do a variable elimination, right?
No, forget about it. Don't ask me a question which is kind of a leading question.
No, I mean,
did I ask something in the exam? But you should, if you don't understand something, you can always ask me. You know, it doesn't matter whether you come in the exam or not.
Factoring, in that thing. Now you were doing the summation part, remember?
Uh-huh.
In class in the slide. I'll show you the slide.